This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and thank you for tuning in to the African American Studies channel at the New Books Network. My name is Brittany Michelle Edmonds, and I'm very excited to be here with my guest today, Dr. Elizabeth McHenry, who will talk about her newest book, To Make Negro Literature, Writing, Literary Practice, and African American Authorship. Dr. McHenry is a professor of English at New York University, and author of Forgotten Readers, Recovering the Lost History of African American Literary Societies. Thank you for being here today, Dr. McHenry.
Thank you for having me.
So I wanted to get started by just hearing a bit about the book and also, you know, the process for coming to the topic. You know, how did you get interested in writing your book? Are there links between this book and your first book? Or do you feel like you were starting something entirely new with this project?
That's a good question. And it's so funny just having finished a book to go back the what for me was a long, long way to figure out, you know, where did it come from and how did it come about? So when I was finishing up or when I was writing Forgotten Readers, one of the most satisfying archives that I worked with for that project was Mary Church Terrell's papers at the Library of Congress. And I loved working with those papers. In some ways, those were Terrell's papers were one of my first deep dives into the archives. And I certainly learned a lot about Terrell and the Black Women's Club movement. But I also learned a tremendous amount from those archives about archival research itself. And one of the things I was most fascinated by was the fact that Terrell's archives were full of short stories. At the time, I mean, I knew of, Terrell was a activist and a lecturer and that she'd written a tremendous amount that appears in the African American press. And in fact, her activism, lasted, you know, well into her late age. But I didn't think of her, nor had I ever read, nor had I ever thought of her as a short story writer. And so for some reason, those stories really lingered on with me. And I think part of that was because they were all unpublished. And the other part of it was that her archives also included a huge number of letters to editors that were essentially what we write as cover letters. They introduced the work and they asked, you know, please consider this for publication. And along with those was a huge trove of rejection letters that she had also saved meticulously, that more or less repeated the same message, which was that her short stories were not going to be published. And those were from a very different set of journals than the ones that she actually was published in. They were from the leading literary journals, rather than the African American press, where in fact she had focused her work, or the bulk of her writing. And so in some ways, I felt like, you know, there was some story there that I kept kind of revolving around and returning to. And so very early, I wrote an article that appeared in American Literary History that was on Terrell's work. And it was really, you know, it was when I talked about her work as failure. And I was really talking about the sort of disjunction between what we think of when we think of Terrell, which is incredible success, and what she thought of her own literary accomplishments. And what she said was that she had failed as a short story writer. And so in some ways, that whole notion of literary failure really haunted me and stayed with me even beyond when I wrote the article. And it also made me really curious about this particular moment in African-American literary history. And that is the years that surround the turn from the 19th to the 20th century. And I played with that time frame. I mean, I first thought I was writing a book that was really on the years from 1900 to 1910. And, you know, then I thought it was the years, you know, maybe before the Harlem Renaissance, so a wider, slightly wider time frame. And then I thought, well, maybe it was before World War I. But really, what never left was this interest in what I originally thought of was a time period when what we see, what is widely recognized, is a very, very small handful of Black writers. And so, you know, initially I thought, well, you know, we think of that as a period of Paul Laurence Dunbar writing poetry, though, of course, he died very early in the 20th century. We think of it as this moment that is associated with Charles Chestnut. And though, of course, he published, you know, with a major publisher, but it was an experiment that for the most part also failed, in that, they published a couple books by him, but then they would not publish his later books. And, he had to return from, authorship as a professional occupation to his job as a stenographer. And we think of it, you know, and to some extent, with someone like James Weldon Johnson, though, James Weldon Johnson's, book, The Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man, which he published in 1912, really we associate more clearly with its rediscovery during the Harlem Renaissance. So there were all these like intriguing things about this period. And this was way back in like 2003, quite honestly, after I'd published my first book. And so, you know, in the intervening years, I feel like we know a lot more about, you know, certain authors from that period. But generally speaking, I think it's still one of those periods that is sort of understudied in African-American literary history. And it's associated more clearly with like larger timeframes. Like we've thought of it as, you know, part of a quote unquote new Negro Renaissance that essentially culminates in the Harlem Renaissance. And that's one, you know, sort of grouping. And we've also thought about it in terms of a sort of postbellum pre-Harlem time period, which might begin in 1877 with the end of Reconstruction. And that's also a sort of longer time period that I think doesn't do justice to these particular constellation of questions and efforts that were really part of a tighter time frame.
No, that's really great. You know, your question touched on so many things that I eventually want to talk about. You know, I was really struck, you know, I'm not a 19th century literary scholar. And so I was struck by your framing of this period. And I had never noticed the ways in which, whole swaths of years are just sort of grouped and what's sort of lost by that. And so where I want to go next before we start talking about things like literary failure, about Terrell, who it's interesting that she was the sort of seed for the book because she shows up at the end of this volume. I also want to talk about AA Lit and as a cultural formation, which you're thinking about not quite as African-American literature. We're going to talk about your title a bit. But I'm really curious about what you have to say about established literary history. Like in your introduction, you say that you're really interested in this area that literary scholars kind of don't know, a set of concerns that literary scholars haven't really explored, and you largely attribute it to scholarly neglect. And so I'm curious about what that means for you, about the methodology you employ to uncover some of the stories that you uncover in this volume. And also, you know, what I was also struck by were the different sort of literary publics that you're sort of making visible to literary scholars, right? Your whole first half of the book is thinking about people who are semi-literate, who have aspirations to becoming literate, or maybe even people who have aspirations to something that you call sort of literariness. And so I'm curious if you could talk a bit about methodology with respect to sort of established literary histories and some of the work you're doing in this volume.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in some sense, what I came to understand more clearly, what I sort of was grappling with, was the way that we literary scholars tend to focus on the most visible moments, and by visible, I mean those moments where there are many, many, many published authors, where there are sort of fascinating, visible, highly visible things, movements going on, and the other thing I think we have focused on in maybe the last couple of decades is this idea of, for instance, the long 19th century. I don't think we've focused yet on a long 20th century, but the long 19th century, and of course that has been tremendously useful in many respects. But I think that what tends to happen is, and this is particularly true, I would argue, in African-American literary history of the Harlem Renaissance, is that those particularly visible moments make it harder for us to see those less visible moments and make it harder for us to see the ways that we then, in part because of the visibility of certain moments, are less critical, I think, about what we think of when we think of a successful literary movement, or even, you know, what constitutes literary history. So my argument in the book really is that that if we only take into consideration as components of literary history those most visible and most prominent authors or movements or time periods, then we don't do justice to certainly what makes up a literary history, which in many respects it depends upon that which doesn't become visible or remain visible, as it does on those movements that, for whatever reason, do remain visible. And I think that for me, the beginning of the 20th century, or the very end of the 19th century, is very much that kind of movement—a movement that is not that had incredibly important aspects to it, that had incredibly important writing and practitioners and literary, what I came to call literary attempts, but many of those we can't really see anymore because they didn't result in the kinds of things that we associate with literary history, or that make for the most recognizable forms of literary history. So one of those is obviously publication, publication obviously, you know, is hugely important, in part because it results in texts that last. Efforts that are visible in part because they resulted in projects that were put between boards, which we know is one way that one thing that preserves texts. I mean, literally, quite honestly, and quite literally, makes them last longer. So for instance, you know. Books are collected in libraries. Things that are unpublished usually are thrown out. And I think we're really fortunate in the case of Mary Church Terrell, for instance, because she saved what she wrote. She purposefully sort of created this archive of her failure, right, of things that didn't work. So part of what I'm interested in this book is expanding what I call the map by which we know literary history, and thinking back through not only what was published looks like what we think of as literary history, but also those elements of literary history that we don't widely recognize or appreciate from literary history. And I I do suggest that scholarly neglect is part of the reason why, for instance, we don't know the literary moment in which I investigate in this book. And part of that, like, for instance, you pointed to the first chapter. I mean, one of the things I pointed to in the first chapter is these books that are everywhere. I mean, they appeared everywhere. They're still pretty easily found, but they've been largely dismissed because they don't look like the kind of literature that we think of or call or recognize as literature. They look like something that is kind of boring and kind of specifically that borrows from other earlier texts. So kind of looks unoriginal, kind of looks uncreative. And all those things are true. And yet the texts themselves really mark an important, not only sort of moment in literary history, but an important form of literature that helps us to recognize different kinds of readers and different constellations of literary history.
Yeah. So my question following that, you know, I feel like it almost answers itself, but I want to ask it anyway, is, you know, you're uncovering all of these sort of books, these sort of failed literary attempts by sort of figures that we think we know. I'm curious how much of that has to deal with the particularity of the historical period that you're studying around the 20th century and the tension between sort of Black civic possibility and sort of Black literary possibility that emerges after, you know, kind of the dashed dreams of Reconstruction, right? Because you kind of keep gesturing towards that throughout the book. And so I'm curious, do these sort of failed attempts matter more because of that historical backdrop, or is this concern with these kinds of failed attempts? Do we think there are other historical moments that would benefit from this kind of literary attention? Yeah.
So I think that's a great question, and I would answer it in two ways. First, I would say, yes, these literary attempts matter more in part because they are against the backdrop of, for instance, Plessy versus Ferguson, and even which is of course a legal, it is a legal case that only confirms what is already evident, which is the racial violence, which is seen in the racial violence, which is seen in the escalation of really racial hatred and the disregard, I mean, for Black bodies certainly, but for Black life that is seen around the turn of the century. And I think that for me, you know, because one of the things that signified is the dashing of political hopes and the frustration of the kind of efforts that might have come out of, you know, the end of the Civil War, that literary practitioners were really, and actually all, you know, Black leadership was really looking for all sorts of, like, of different avenues that they might take towards, you know, what we would call civil rights, and towards the recognition of the importance of, you know, Black lives and Black livelihood. So I do think that this is a particular moment. I would also, though, say that, in fact, there are all sorts of moments that are unrecognizable for their not even literary importance, but for the texture of their literary history, that I think could really benefit for a more granular approach. It's so funny because when I decided to go towards this particular project, because I am trained as a 19th century African Americanist, I was debating between two time periods that I was sort of curious about. And I am not exactly sure why I thought of this next project as one about time periods. But I think in part because my first book covered a tremendous a huge, you know, over a century of Black literature. I was actually interested in doing something that was much more like tightly focused. But the other period I was really concerned with, or I was thinking about, and still sort of haunts me and seems worthy of reinvestigation, is that period between the Civil War and 1877. Basically, that period before the end of Reconstruction, which for me it has actually been investigated in really profitable ways in terms of looking at newspapers like the Christian Recorder, for instance, and actually I think newspapers are one key to looking at the literary history of this particular moment. But the point is, I think there are many other periods that we might think of as approaching in a really tight and sort of, again, granular way, to get more clearly and more firmly, not in an attempt to argue for either a different sort of periodization for African-American literature or for the importance, you know, of or even to make that period like in competition with something like the Harlem Renaissance, but simply to have a better grasp of what our literary history really looks like, what has been part of its history. And I think it helps us to answer in different ways all sorts of other questions that we have about African-American literature. For instance, who was its readership? How were its texts, you know, distributed and consumed to some degree? You know, what was the nature of African-American authorships at different moments, you know, throughout the 19th and 20th century?
Yeah, no, that's great. You know, I really love, you know, going back to that line you said earlier about expanding the map by which we know literary history, and thinking about your project as not sort of being one of you know, sort of competing periodizations. But I'm still curious about the title of your book, and you talk about it a bit in the introduction. But to make Negro literature, it seems to invite a kind of scrutiny, right? Because it's Negro literature, not African-American literature. And obvious, as you say, you know, in your introduction, it's a callback to Kenneth Warren's polemic. And so I'm curious about maybe not competing periodization, but like, what is the relationship of this period, of the kinds of moments that you are drawing out? What is the relationship between that and, you know, what we already know, maybe like a conventional literary history, right? These authors, these writers, these kinds of books, these forms of literary failure, these literary attempts, what relation do they bear to, you know, the Harlem Renaissance, for example?
Yeah, so it's funny because I've always thought of this book as being really tightly focused on, you know, this moment that was charged by this name, by this moniker, Negro, and so it's been interesting to hear people ask about the name, and I don't feel like people have questioned it, and I hope people aren't offended by it. But I think it's been really important. My feeling has always been that it's been really important to in some way recognize the particularity of this moment, in terms of the ways that the term Negro was claimed by Black people and by literary scholars, by intellectuals, by Black intellectuals, really, and the way that for them it spoke to, you know, a new moment, a new attempt, a new identity, and of course that terrain has been covered by Henry Louis Gates and by my former colleague Jean Jarrett in really fruitful ways, but what I really want to get at in this book is is not a movement or a moment, but really, you know, what it meant to be sort of forging this new path to claiming this new name in terms of the making of literature. For me, that is a specific, in some ways, it's a specific tale to be told. For me, it is told not through the published literature, not through, for instance, the story of Paul Laurence Dunbar and Charles Chestnut, though I do think those stories are central also to this particular moment, but really through these stories that that haven't come to light, that don't come to light if you're looking at Black literature in some respects traditional ways, so that word is loaded. I mean, it's loaded for me, and I think it is in part loaded because Ken Warren, in some ways, specifically avoids using that word. When I say avoids, he doesn't avoid using it. He says, I could have used that word, but I didn't. My using of that word, you know, specifically signals, you know, my interest in really getting at the texture of this particular moment, not making a larger argument about the periodicity about African-American literature, or even making a claim to when African-American literature begins and ends. What I'm not arguing is that before this moment, there was nothing called either Negro literature or African-American literature. But my interest is really getting at this particular moment. And I think one way of doing so is to acknowledge the ways that that literary practitioners use this term deliberately, meaningfully, and in an attempt to do something that they considered different, not different in terms of creating a literature that was not there before, but different in terms of trying to make this literature speak in a sort of a new and different way. And I think that new and different way had everything to do with you know, their frustrations with, for instance, political attempts. I don't see it as, you know, my job is not to pull this literature out and make it something that is distinct from what came before and what came after, but to recognize again, you know, something that was an attempt to really ground this literature in a way that would see it forward, from as growing out of the 19th century, but also moving forward into the 20th century. You asked me another part, but I can't remember what it was.
I mean, well, what you just said is a really beautiful answer. I think the second part, I was just kind of curious about thinking about this moment in relationship to what follows.
The Harlem Renaissance,
You know, specifically thinking about readership, specifically thinking about the institutional forms that African-American literature as a cultural formation takes up. Mm-hmm. I mean, related to that question is where I was going to pivot in our next question, so it might be another two-parter. But I was really curious, you know, reading across your book, I was really curious about this question of, I guess, like institutionalization and thinking about the great deal of organization that it took to reach certain kinds of readers. If we're thinking about the sort of book agents that you describe in the first chapter, or if we're thinking about the sort of newspapers that had the sort of letters printed in them and then had, you know, folks going to different sections to learn different things. And so I was curious about it on that hand, right? The high level of sort of organization and strategy that it took to reach a kind of aspiring Black literate public. And also the ways in which, you know, so many of these sort of Black figures, these Black actors and the sort of who are interested in promoting Black literacy were kind of disbarred from institutions or sort of subordinated or dismissed in certain ways. And I'm thinking here sort of most prominently about Murray, who you talk about for quite a bit. And so this question of institutionality and just, you know, how this moment becomes what comes after it and the relationship between them was something that I was thinking about the entire time I was reading.
Yeah, so I mean, my own sense is that this moment is one reason why this moment is so important is because it does lay the groundwork for what comes later. And I think probably more importantly, the writers are conscious of laying the groundwork for what comes later, right? This is not an unconscious moment. And this doesn't, you know, this is something that takes place throughout the history of Black literature, is that the groundwork is part of the objective of the literature itself. And you can see that as far back as, I mean, even earlier, but David Walker talks about, you know, how essential it is to build a readership and to share literacy. And throughout the 19th century, we have other examples of these kinds of sort of infrastructural gestures. But I think they become particularly important, visible at this moment. And I think that has to do not only with what's going on sort of in Black intellectual circles, but also what's going on in the world of education in the US and throughout the world. I mean, you have to remember that at this moment in the United States is when all sorts of things are taking place. One is the professional organizations and the professionalization of things like library studies. And the other thing that was new to me was the professionalization of literally bibliography as a field of study. And so when Murray, for instance, takes it upon himself and is charged with creating these bibliographies of Black literature, he's not doing that in a vacuum. And he's also, you know, he's not formally trained as a librarian, but he's certainly a part of that world of the Library of Congress. And so his work to organize books is also part of a larger effort to organize the discipline of literary study, what we would now call sort of English more broadly, and to establish what is American literature. You know, what does it look like? What are its parameters? What counts? What doesn't count? How will we be known? You know, by our literature. And what one thing that Murray did, of course, which was so exceptional, was he insisted that Black literature be part of this, not only by making his bibliographies and, in fact, continuing to his bibliographical work throughout his lifetime, but also by insisting in his correspondence, in the way that he made his lists public, that any list of American literature should also include lists of Negro literature. And so I do think that this period was one of organization, even in the way that in my first chapter, I looked at these books that, you know, that it is possible were sold to people who did not have the ability to read. And one of the things that those authors do, the authors of those books do, is that they organize previously published bodies of writing into groupings that are more easily digested, more easily consumed by readers who might not have had the stamina, the literary ability to read longer pieces. So I do think that this organization was consciously designed around building not only an idea of Negro literature, but also a body of a population of readers who were increasingly sophisticated at not only their literacy, but also their literary ability. And what I mean by that is it really the critical thinking skills, all the things that we associate with literary study that we today teach our students in class, close reading skills, analytical skills, all of those, it seems to me, were part of what literary practitioners during this moment were thinking about. And they were thinking about how would the study of Black literature be organized? How would the study of Black literature take place? And how would the study of Black lives, Black history, you know, all these different sort of categories that we now think of as Black studies, how would that take place? So when you look ahead, certainly to something like the Harlem Renaissance, but even beyond that, I think that there are all kinds of ways in which this infrastructural work had lasting effects. Du Bois has this great line that he says, I think it's in 1913, and I cite it in the book. He says, he talks about a moment, he talks about work that had not yet or been done. He says it's a really weird construction, but it perfectly captures this anticipation of later moments, of moments where writing, where writers, where readers, and where the importance of Black literature generally would be recognized in ways that the constellation of writers, practitioners, publications that I look at only anticipate that sort of thing. And Terrell herself, it seems to me, by saving her rejection letters, by continuing even after she knew that her writing was not going to end up in the pages, that her short stories specifically were not going to end up in the pages of like Harper's Magazine, she continued to submit them to these same journals as a way to insist that her writing belonged there, that it should be published there, and to show, to make an argument, to mount an argument with these editors, these white editors, that they should open up their pages to Black writers, and that they should be willing to not to follow public opinion, but to create these forums, to open up these venues of publication. And that certainly was done at a time that she recognized that she was not going to have success with her writing, but that future writers, future Black writers, might find a place for their writing in these journals because of her work.
Yeah, no, that's great. You know, I really liked your account there of the infrastructural work of this period. One of the images that, you know, really stuck in my mind while reading your book was the image of, you know, the sort of farm worker sort of resting at the end of each row and then sort of reading like a lesson in the newspaper or a book. And that was contrasted with that famous image from Booker T. Washington's, I want to say it's Up from Slavery, where he's sort of describing it, the saddest thing he's ever seen. It's like a boy in some like dirty home out in the middle of nowhere reading a French grammar book. And so I guess what I'm curious about is if you could say a bit more about your concept of school books. I mean, school books.
Yeah, school
books. And, you know, what it means to actually do this infrastructural work, right? Like what it means in the 19th century to be thinking about, we want to sort of cultivate, you keep describing this as the move from literacy to a kind of literary culture. You know, what does that look like in the terms of the newspapers and some of the other materials that you're looking at in your volume?
Let me just go backwards a little bit to give some context to what I'm going to say going forward. One thing that I think has struck many, many scholars of Black literary history and print culture is the extent to which we know a tremendous amount about readers in the North, and about Black readers in the North, and about Black readers who are well-educated and privileged enough to have access to education. But we know far less about readers in the South, where there were fewer opportunities for education, fewer opportunities for access to literary material, and certainly a shorter history, a less dense history of literary interaction. So that's always been, for me, a problem. And in part, it's a problem because it was something I couldn't get at, I didn't get at in my first book. So in this book, I didn't set out to figure out, you know, where were readers from the South in all of this, in the equation. But I came across these books that were sold by subscription that were essentially disregarded by Northern readers, but were sold in great quantities in the South and in the Midwest. And they were sold by subscription, which meant that they were sold by agents who went door to door in order to essentially find people willing to pay for a book that they only saw in a very abbreviated form before they bought what would then be a complete book. So they saw a partial book, and based on that, based on the binding, based on the agent's enthusiasm for what the book contained, based on pictures largely, they subscribed for a book. And what it made me realize, because these books are chopped up versions of other books, but what it made me realize was that they were windows into both, you know, how Black readers in the South or Black people in the South, whether they were actually literate or not, how they gained access to reading material, how they came to value books, how they came to a greater understanding of what reading was and what it could do. And part of what I came to have a much firmer grasp on is the extent to which, you know, we think of literacy, it's like you're either illiterate or you're literate. But literacy was something that was practiced, something that was worked on, something that was extended over someone's whole lifetime. It's still that way, right? It's still something that, you know, we practice, and not something that we go from, you know, being illiterate to being literate. And so what I came to understand was that these books in many ways were their own school. They were a place where Black people could practice their literacy, where they could learn how reading might fit into their lives, and where they could make that movement from using literacy and reading material to get information to using reading material to come to better understandings of, you know, for instance, their own history and their own positioning. They could use these books to practice getting a greater understanding of the kind of material they were reading and the kind of the ways that people had viewed them, the ways that other writers had described, had communicated the position of Black people, their history, their value. So that was one piece of it. But to understand them as school books, I had to really get outside of the way that we traditionally think of education for Black people at the end of the 19th century, because we are consumed with what we think we know, which is what scholars have largely talked about, that divide between Booker T. Washington's perspective on and his valuing of industrial education, of learning trades, of Black people being restricted even to learning trades as a way to ensure their economic viability. And W.E.B. Du Bois's notion of the importance of higher education. And in many ways, again, there are plenty of scholars that have talked about what I call self-education, that have talked about the ways that Black people have ensured their own literacy. But to think of this as a major strain of education, of Black education at the end of the 19th century is, I think, is really important, because it is the way that you understand how insufficient both of these modes of education were. One, Booker T. Washington's higher education, because it was available to so few Black people, relatively speaking. The other, because it was so limited in the way in what it taught Black people. But these books and a host of other forms of self-education, but these books did, I argue, two things. One is it extended literacy, the education of reading. It offered forms of reading and texts for reading, but also advanced what I think of as like literary training. And the other is that neither higher education nor industrial education were teaching Black studies. In other words, the history of Black people in the world, in a global context, and also specifically the achievements of Black people in a global context, but also specifically in the United States. And these books that I identify as school books, did both of those things. And for a population that was that we generally associate with even at the turn from the 19th to the 20th century, with high rates of illiteracy. But these books offered a way for readers to go from essentially reading pictures, reading the kinds of things that illustrated these books, to reading small bits of text, to reading larger bits of text, with guidance from the subheadings and subtitles that the editors, the authors put in those texts, to comparing texts, right? To reading texts by full texts by people who were well known in Black leadership, and comparing, for instance, something Booker T. Washington said to something that Alexander Crummell said. So I think that, you know, this idea of thinking about or expanding our understanding of how Black people were educated, or how they educated themselves, or to include how they educated themselves, even as late as the turn of the 20th century, is really important. And I think it opens up room for thinking about, for instance, Alain Locke's 1940s collections that he designed specifically for working class people, to offer them something that resembled like a university or a university curriculum, but designed for different populations. This offers a context for that, which I think is really important for helping us to better appreciate those later projects.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite parts of your book, was reading about, you know, the agent going door to door and reading this sort of script and thinking about, you know, the agent having to sort of strategize how he was going to get sort of a town full of poor people who maybe can't read well, or maybe don't even own any books other than a Bible, how to get them interested in what it is he's selling, and just having to meet the preacher first or the teachers first or whatever it is to get into that community and sell people books. It's just like a really beautiful part of your book, because I just did not know that history. I didn't realize that there would be Black, you know, door-to-door book salesman, right? Like, that's not even something that crossed my mind. And so it's just really beautiful to also think about sort of cultivating a desire for books as material objects, that being something that's not only new to sort of Black folks, but just sort of generally in the 19th century.
Interesting that these books have been really devalued because what people have said is that, you know, people bought them for show. People just bought them to sit on the shelves. They never, you know, they weren't even opened. But instead of thinking of that as a reason to dismiss these books, what is helpful is to really get at, you know, why did they value those books, even if they couldn't read them? And how did those books get into people's homes if they didn't value books? And one of my favorite, just my last thing on this, one of my favorite things that I just learned about the way these books were sold is that the publishers for these books, and you can't forget that these were commercial ventures. So the point of the publisher was to make money. But the publishers for these books, they watched, for instance, the cotton crop. And if the cotton crop was good, they went into those communities because they knew people had money. And, you know, it may not have been a lot of money, and it certainly, I'm sure, you know, for our own contemporary standards, wasn't, but the ways of selling these books is fascinating. Even as you acknowledge that part of the reason why people bought these books was because they thought they looked great, that the cover was, you know, gilded in some way that made it even more attractive.
Yeah, no, that's great. Well, you know, we're ending down on time, but, you know, I wanted to ask a question. You know, one of the projects you said that you're sort of engaging in this volume is sort of thinking about definitions of authorship. And so you just brought that a little bit with your last comment, thinking that these books aren't really taken seriously. You know, there's not really sort of original authorship in them. You named three types of authorship. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the last one, but all three is fine if you want to touch on them. But you named curational, collective, and then managed construction. And I feel like we've talked a bit about the first two across this interview, but we haven't talked so much about managed construction. So could you say a bit about that?
Yeah. So that brings me to one of my favorite/least favorite chapters of the book. It is actually a favorite chapter, but it is the chapter that I was very reluctant to go into. And I went only because that's where the story went. And that is a chapter on Booker T. Washington. And I say that, but in fact, the chapter is not on Booker T. Washington. It's really on T. Thomas Fortune, who I argue really at around the turn of the century made it his business, made it his responsibility to manage the authorship of Booker T. Washington. And I don't use, I think I use it once, but I use it to pull back from it, the term ghostwriter, because I don't use it specifically because I think it offers us both a false sense of their relationship, but also it introduces a term that we think we know and a relationship that we don't have a lot of respect for. What I try and do is I really take apart what it meant for T. Thomas Fortune to both write for Booker T. Washington, but also to manage the construction of his authorship, the construction of the image of his authorship. And that included not only writing for him, but also editing his work, advising him on what he should or shouldn't write, topics, and also in terms of things that he was asked to write. You know, should he write for that publication or even that specific editor? Was it worth his time? Was it worth his effort? And so what I try and get at is really what it meant to write for, to work for, to construct the authorship of another person. And I make a distinction between authorship as like a public posture and writing as a embodied labor. And I try and look at what that labor literally entailed. And I also look at what that labor cost, because Fortune was very, very, very clear on exactly what he felt his labor was worth as an author. I think money is one of the things that I was most fascinated by in that chapter. But also, I think it's become something I'm really interested in, because I think we have ignored, in some sense, or under-theorized the importance of money, of cost, in African-American literary history. But the way that that Fortune focused on money, the way that he was paid and underpaid, the way he was compensated in various ways, it becomes a really important part of the story of the relationship between Washington and Fortune. And I also think a lot about the way his own writing, when I say suffered, the way his own aspirations for writing did not follow what he, I think, hoped would happen. I think he hoped if he constructed Booker T. Washington as an author, then it would give a certain prominence to Black writing. And I think it did in terms of cementing Washington's leadership, cementing his image as a leader, which Fortune rightly, I think, understood as something that would be really augmented by being seen as an author, specifically of books. But I think he also wanted to make a center for Black literature, and a center for Black literature, which would really cement the idea of Black literature and the prominence of Black literature. I would argue that in the long run, that certainly happened. But in the short run, in terms of Fortune's own success with his own writing, he is very much like Terrell in that he had aspirations to be seen and in fact worked on a novel, poetry, all sorts of different forms of literature, but he didn't enjoy the same kind of publishing success that he earned for Washington. And part of that obviously is because of Washington's prominence. But it's a complicated story, I think, and really helps to cement the kinds of ways that even what counted as authorship, right? The various forms of authorship looked like in at the turn of the century.
Yeah, that's really great. Well, to end, I'm just curious about, this is going to be our last question. I'm curious about, you know, overall how you see the book just sort of fitting into the field of 19th century African-American literary study, how you see it being used in graduate classrooms and undergraduate classrooms, but also, I mean, what you would hope for it in terms of ongoing conversations in the field.
So I think one of the biggest interventions it makes is just in sort of reconceptualizing the idea of failure and what it means, or the possibilities of looking at writers that, you know, by our own standards did not succeed. I think that, you know, thinking about the ways that quote unquote failed writers and writing fits into or become how we might account for that in literary history, broadly conceived, is a really it's a really important question, and one that's certainly not solved or entirely clarified by my work, but I hope it raises questions about the ways that, you know, about what counts as literary history, about how we go about thinking and talking and writing about the literary history that we see. So that's one thing. I also hope it just in terms of thinking about the various materials that are included in studies. I think it is. You know, we are ever increasing the kinds of things that we think of when we think of, again, what counts as literary history. And I think that you know, if we can continue to move away from thinking about only novels and poetry and maybe drama, you know, and the most obvious things as components of literary history, that will go a long way to getting at the nuances of what we work with, what materials we value. I also think, you know, anytime that we can work more closely with the archives that are available to us, in addition to building new archives, that's a plus. And that finding ways to value various aspects of literary history that aren't only just claiming things as, you know, new additions to a canon of African-American literature, you know, that I think that, you know, getting away from that as the only or even the prime objective of recovery work, of what we call recovery work, it presents a valuable example for new scholars on how they might work with the archives. One thing that people have asked me just recently is, you know, how I get from my work in the archives, like, you know, all the riches that the archives have to offer, to the story, you know, the story that you actually tell, like, you know, in some ways the final book, but how do you see the narrative in it all? And I think that for me, that's been really thinking back over, I mean, I don't know how you teach that. But to acknowledge the amount of time that takes, the difficulty of doing that, I think, for students, is also really important, because I think that's the trick, right? There are amazing archival researchers, but to be able to pull that story out, right, and to weed down what you have to the story that you can see, that's a trick. And it's a trick, I should just say, that is not done in solitude, right? I mean, you do it through all the friends and colleagues that read your work, and they help you suss out what's most important. But I think, you know, to find examples of how that's done is sort of, you know, a crucial stage in student life.
Yeah, I will say, you know, I thought that was one of the most beautiful aspects of your book, just all these stories that I did not know about African-American literature. Well, thank you for being with me here today. You know, it's been great to be in conversation with you about this book, and I really hope and encourage everyone to go out and to buy Elizabeth McHenry's To Make Negro Literature, Writing Literary Practice and African-American Authorship. Thank you.
Thank you.